We meet the third friend of Job today, so it's Zophar's turn. There was an ad in the local newspaper that read, purebred, there it is, purebred police dog, $25. Thinking that was a great bargain, Mrs. Jones ordered the dog to be brought to her house to be delivered. And the next day, a van pulled up and left her the mangiest-looking mongrel she had ever seen. In a rage, she telephoned the man who had placed the ad. What do you mean, call that mangy mutt a purebred police dog? Don't be deceived by his looks, ma'am, he said. He works undercover. You know, trusting words and sifting through words that we hear is a real challenge, isn't it? There are always people, even people who are close to us, who bend the truth, who stretch the truth, or confuse the truth to hide things from us. The worst kind of words used, I think, are words offered that sound so good, so helpful, that we cannot see the hidden reality of the emptiness of those words. Now, already Job has been accused by his friends of speaking to the wind. But what of his three friends? Is there any meat in their words? In meeting Job's friend Zophar, we begin to recognize how beautiful and convincing their words really are. Much of what Zophar says, we might hardly agree with. And maybe we've even shared similar words with friends and family. However, because it is a temptation before all of us to use platitudes or simple conclusions to comfort and counsel our friends, we have to tread very carefully with Job's friends. I remind you at the very outset today that some of the harshest words that Jesus ever spoke to anyone that we have in the scriptures were directed towards the so-called experts who claimed to know the truth. The Sadducees and Pharisees and the scribes, all of them claimed moral and intellectual superiority. But Jesus, how does he describe them? He says they are like whitewashed tombs. And actually, at the very end of this journey, we will see that God says to Zophar that he has not spoken right about him. Zophar begins his exposition today with a very cruel statement. I mean, it's really cruel. He tells Job that he should just shut up and listen. Zophar concludes that Job's words are plentiful, but they are meaningless. Zophar is indignant that Job would be allowed to say the things he says. Job cannot and will not have the last word, Zophar believes. Someone needs to shame Job into acknowledging that he's wrong here. For Job to claim his doctrine is pure and he is pure before God, we used the word blameless earlier on, is absolutely ridiculous. But that's really not what Job said, is it? Job admits that his situation has thrown all of his thinking into a great confusion. Zophar continues to state that Job's a hypocrite. He claims faith in God, but clearly demonstrates with his words that he doesn't believe in God at all. Zophar wants God to answer Job, and he is pretty confident that God will take Zophar's position on this matter. Then Zophar says something that's even more unhelpful. In verse 6 of the sentence that reveals Zophar's heart in all of this, know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Restated, Zophar is saying to Job, you going bankrupt, you losing all your animals and your farm hands, your children getting killed and your health ruined, is only payback for the unforgiven sin in your life. It is a thoroughly cruel thing to say to anyone, especially a man who is as far down as Job is. What is equally awful is that there are still Christian people in the world today that think that's how the universe works. I've heard over the years some pretty terrible theology expressed by pastors and laypersons who claim that whatever calamity has befallen you is your own fault for not confessing your sin. Have you heard that before? Remember years ago, there were TV preachers who said that Hurricane Katrina was God's judgment on the people of New Orleans for being sinful. Zophar is also showing how arrogant he is as a person. He really believes he knows what's going on. And because he himself is not suffering, that's key here, then he has more moral authority than Job. Maybe you've encountered similar people in your life. The sad part of Zophar's attitude and his conclusions about himself is that it mars what is actually in Zophar's mouth, a very beautiful description of God's wisdom. It's a gorgeous piece of work. Zophar's words talk of the deep things of God, talk of the limits of the Almighty. The first speaks to the heart of God, and the second to the outer limits of God's authority and power. And there are no outer limits. Therefore, God fills the whole of the known and the unknown universe. Therefore, he says, Job could never hope to know in such a way as to act on God's knowledge. It would be good words if Zophar applied them to himself. But he doesn't. He speaks of a courtroom where God examines a person and declares them worthless. It's just like when someone is convicted of a terrible crime and they are sentenced to jail or some other punishment. Job, therefore, in Zophar's mind, is a worthless man. He's been judged and he's found lacking. To challenge God's authority, Zophar says, is as stupid as a donkey giving birth to a human being. But in all this, Zophar arrogantly believes this is important. He arrogantly believes that he understands God. To fix the situation, all Job needs to do, he says, is repent and pray. Prepare your heart, Zophar says. Whatever you're holding on to, Job, that's wicked, let it go. Then and only then, Job, will you truly be found blameless. Sure, your situation is bad, but consider that water under the bridge. Think of it as waking up from a nightmare. This is kind of what happens at the end of the book, isn't it? But there are really two problems with what Zophar is really saying to Job. The first is, as we know from chapters 1 and 2, Job doesn't have any secret sins in which to repent of. Zophar's counsel, therefore, to Job is absolutely irrelevant. The second one is even more serious. Zophar is telling Job that if he repents, he will again be a prosperous man. That's the same motivation that Satan accused Job of having in the very beginning of the book. And it led to all this terrible stuff. If he does what Zophar urges him to do, the Satan will be proven right. The bottom line is that Zophar's words are that they are cruel, they are arrogant, and they are from someone who should know better. How is any of this from these three men comforting to Job? H.H. Rowley writes, by insisting that there is such a thing as innocent suffering, the author of Job is bringing a message of first importance to the sufferer. The hardest part of his suffering need not be the feeling that he's deserted by God or fear that all men may regard him as cast out from God's presence. If his suffering may be innocent, it may not spell isolation from God, and when he most needs the sustaining presence of God, he will have it. Well, Job can't handle this chastisement from Zophar. He can't let it go unchallenged. But behind this is the point that Job still doesn't know, why is this happening to me? And yet we know, don't we? From chapters 1 and 2. Why do we get to know and Job doesn't? Well, two possible reasons are that it gives us insight into suffering, which ultimately will point to the suffering of Jesus. We know that Jesus was also troubled at times. He recoiled from the horror of the cross, and he struggled to live a perfect life in a fallen and corrupt world. But it's also true that we are constantly slipping into knowing what we know, and not knowing what we know. We know because God told us that there is such a thing as undeserved and redemptive suffering. And by walking in Jesus' footsteps, we believers are called on to suffer. It's hard to hear, isn't it? We know as forgiven people, none of our suffering is punishment for sin. We're forgiven. We do know that some of our suffering is God's fatherly discipline. We've talked about that. And also our suffering is a filling out of what was lacking in Jesus' suffering. Even if it seems undeserved and without feeling, we're participating in that suffering. Job's response to Zophar is reminding us that We know what we know. We already know this. To remember the default understanding of suffering, that is, we deserve it, is not true. And this needs all of us to understand it as a comfort when we go through terrible circumstances. Chapters 12 and 14 are the longest of Job's speeches in this book. Needless to say, as I pointed out, I can't unwrap everything here for you, but you can dig on your own for the gold that's here. The heart of his words is simply that the system, the religious system that his three friends are adhering to and promoting does not work. The system they follow is deceitful, it's shallow, and I would add very cruel. Job resolves after this to take his case directly to God, because his friends are no help at all to him. But first he responds to Zophar, but really he's talking to all three of them. He begins very sarcastically to saying something like, "Oh, you guys are so special. The world would be devoid of all wisdom when you're gone." At least in their own opinion. Zophar concluded Job was a fool, but Job points out that he's just as qualified as they are to be wise. He knows the system as well as they do. They haven't told him anything he didn't already know. "I am blameless," Job insists, "but I've become a laughingstock. I've become an object of mockery." Why, he goes on, to those who live in ease as his friends do, despise those who are suffering misfortune. Because according to the system, that religious system, that you get what you deserve, they are less than the elite, those who suffer. Job jabs at them with his words, "He jests who never felt a wound." Wow, those are good words. Job explains that the system is shallow. Even creation itself will tell you what has happened to me is God's doing. Just because we have a number of years on us and have been around the block a few times does not mean we understand anything. The system his friends are promoting is cruel and shallow. Job speaks of the fact that this system of theirs is tame. God is no simple spectator in creation that he set things in motion and then sat back. God is fully active and involved in everything. In fact, Les C.S. Lewis for this, reminding us of this, God is dangerous. You know that in the Chronicles of Narnia, the character Aslan, what does C.S. Lewis say about him? He's dangerous, but good. God builds and tears down, Job says. If God locks someone up, there's no one who can get him out. God is ferocious, he says, sometimes giving too little water and sometimes too much. Well, just ask the people of BC how they managed to summer with too much water. Even those in leadership are vulnerable to God's control as he appoints some and then he deposes others. The same holds true for religious leaders too. Our perceived order of leadership is useless. It's vulnerable. God brings to light those things of the dark that people like to hide. God takes away human wisdom and makes people wander around like they're in a wasteland. God is dangerous, Job is saying. Especially to those who hold on to that religious system that his friends are promoting. A system that doesn't work. If the whole system is worthless, then Job says he must go directly to God and plead his case. But before he does this, he tells his friends that what they are saying is a whitewash of lies. They are painting over the messy reality of the world with shallow, thin coverings, all in an effort to make things all nice and tidy. They are worthless physicians to them. Their treatment is at best a placebo, and at worst it just makes things. He says, you claim to stand up for God, but you do so with untruth. And God desires you to stop this. So courageously, Job decides he's going to talk directly to that dangerous God. I take my flesh in my teeth, he said. This might mean that he's biting his tongue to brace himself to face the danger. Job is saying that God may kill him, but even if he does, I must put my hope in him. Job wants his three friends to listen as he makes his appeal to God to be witnesses for the defense. Job is about to do something very significant here, and we must not water down for a moment how risky Job believes this action is. He's putting it all on the line. Job asked God to remove his hand from him, to give him a break from his misery. If God would just pause this pain, he might find enough strength to speak to God. Job starts by acknowledging that the root problem here is sin. He gets it. God is treating Job like an unrepentant sinner. Job is like a dry leaf blowing in the wind. Job feels that all of this is the accumulation of transgressions since he was a youth. But he'd been giving sacrifices all along to deal with sin. Job feels deeply the misery of mortality, sin. Man wastes away like a garment that is moth-eaten, he says. So fleeting is so much of creation, isn't it? Fruits and flowers, they seem so definite at the moment, but shortly they are just gone. Do you know that Goethe once wrote something that just shook me to my core? He said that near the end of his life, that he could hardly think that he was truly happy for more than a month of his whole life. Wow. Job would agree. Hope in a resurrection. Like the shoot growing out of a cut down tree, that's what Job has left. Job asked that when he dies, that God might hide him away until his wrath has passed. Then God would renew him. It's an intensely personal request. It speaks of a relationship. You would call, Job says, and I would answer you. There's hope, a wonderful hope of a resurrecting God. Job points a picture of a time when all his transgressions are neatly put away, never to be seen again, but Job cannot sustain his hope. At the very end of chapter 14, he lapses back into misery and suffering. Just as you cannot put a hillside back after a landslide, there's no process to reverse the erosion of evil, Job says. Job still sees himself as utterly alone, sitting under the judgment of God. Takeaway lessons from this section of Job are pretty straightforward. Sin is real, a real problem in this world and in each of our lives. Misery is the result of sin if it's not dealt with. And Job knows this. Job knows sin is real. You cannot deny it. You cannot minimize its impact. Job realizes in his speech that sin is the reason for our fragile mortality. Then he also, in spite of the reality of sin, he still clings to hope. Hope in a resurrection. Even though he will die, he will someday meet his Maker. I've said so many times that Job's experience foreshadows the man who will enter fully into the misery of being identified with sinners, life and in death. He will know intimately the fragile nature of the human body and experience all the horrors of the final penalty of sin creates. He will suffer for our sin, but the sinless himself. Also, our sin, yours and mine, they can all be gathered up and sealed up in a garbage bag and disposed of forever. Job also foreshadows our lives as followers of Christ who experience the misery of living in a world of sin and judgment. We, like Job, know intimately our own mortality. We get it. We who are in Christ, we suffer not because of any sin on our part, but because we share in the suffering of Christ for all people. We must also recognize that our adherence to the religious system of Job's friends brings incredible cruelty on those who suffer. We must be brave like Job, recognizing the dangerous nature of God and our dependence on Christ to mediate that danger. And finally, we must place our hope in the resurrection so that we too someday can stand face to face with the God that we have.